basements and they got it all over the wall and everything, but
well,
never did any of that.
Not really. I've seen a couple who've got small displays, but no, not in, let's see, Cecil Travis has a couple of cartoons on his wall.
Does he?
That were given to him by the Washington sports writers. That's about it.
This is probably a lot of the team pictures.
Oh.
Giants and so forth. I know the rules, I guess, get those over
there. Looks like it hasn't been out of there in a while.
They had a beautiful ballpark down in Jersey City. They had, that was a
brand new ballpark that was built in
middle 1930s with WPA.
Uh-huh.
And that was beautiful. I mean, it was a better than a lot of major league
clubs. I can imagine.
Oh, man, that was.
Now, who's on this team? I can't make out. Very many people, certainly.
Maybe remember him this high then as he was there.
Mm-hmm. And this is you over here, am I right?
This is Jensen, Woody Jensen. Big league. Roy Joyner.
I recognize you.
And this is Sambo Leslie. He was first baseman in Philadelphia, I think.
Oh.
But this is in AAA.
Right. Some on the way up, some on the way down.
Yeah. Ed Sid, he played for the Giants.
Sid Gordon?
Sorry.
Yeah, I thought I recognized him.
Did you see some of these? This is Gordon Udall. He's here. Now, this is your pitching coach. He's an old-time catcher. What the hell does he, know about it? We had. In 1939. We won the league championship there. The year before, Jackson was the manager. We had four of the best prospects pitchers, young guys. The end of the year, the middle of the year, none of them could even come in there. Three of them. Had to quit baseball, and their arm never even came back. So you knew something was wrong with the pitching coach. It was the way the pitchers ran, and they wouldn't even pay them their salary. And at the end of the year, Judge Landis, he called me in. I had to go to Judge Landis and tell him the story of what happened and handle these pitchers. They hurt their arms and they sent them home. They wouldn't even pay them.
Landis kept
them. And Landis called me in and asked me the whole story. And made the Giants pay those guys their salary.
Landis kept a close thumb on him.
Yeah, he was a tough nut. He went in front of him, boy. I was going for more like the Grim Reaper.
But you said Travis Jackson managed the year before. Who was the manager? I don't know that name.
Similar to the one the New York Giants. It's built out on a bay, you know what I mean? And at nighttime, it get cold and windy. Boy, I'm being. And they had a beautiful set of lights. But boy, you try to play night baseball there in the middle of summer, and you froze your behind off. It was so cold and windy.
Well, it's too bad you don't have that on a lot. It's a remarkable photograph. I can't imagine how many of those there are still around.
Of what?
Of the Jersey City Giants. Tell until you open them up. How many teams were in the International League at that time?
16, 18?
8.
We had Baltimore.
Was that, was Baltimore an independent team at that time, or were they affiliated with the club?
No, they were independent. Owned by an individual. And then finally, got their big league franchise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were independent. They had Buffalo. New Boudreaux was playing in Buffalo. Newark.
That was the Yankees.
Rochester.
Team, right?
Rochester.
It's hard to put one's hands on everything.
But don't seem like much for 12 years, but I guess that's it.
Well, I think it's an awful lot for 12 years. A great deal indeed. Well, I thank you very much for giving me your time this evening. I feel very privileged.
I hope it fits in with what you're trying to accomplish.
It does, certainly. It does indeed.
And, I'm sure there's other players that can fill it in a lot better than I could. Probably.
No, everybody has their own perspective. And when you get all the perspectives, then you've got what you're after.
But if I would have opened up and got some of these rosters, you know, for 40 and 41 and 42 and realized who I played with, you know, then I could elaborate. Could have elaborated a lot more.
Certainly some names that I know well, some other names that I know not so well. For example, Maury Arnovich. I don't really know that name.
He was a mouthfielder.
Now this is the 41 training season I've got here. And you've got a 42, were there two of those?
46.
46. There's 46. That's also. And there's some names in here that maybe like
well,
you haven't thought of in a while.
46, this is the first year after the war.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's when you're going to get some of the players that were playing during the war years, or that are coming back in 46 that are, aren't going to be around very long, you know what I mean?
Right.
Because of the fellow there is, the old timers are coming back and taking their jobs back. Here's
a name I haven't thought of in a while, Bud Blattner.
He was a successful
sportscaster
right on the West Coast. Bobby Blattner, yeah. You see a lot of names in here where you've never been. Here's Brondell and Mike Budnick. They're not going to be around very long.
No.
Because they're all. They filled a need during the war years, but.
When the other players came back, that'll do it. Walker Cooper?
Walker, of course, his brother was a great pitcher for the St. Louis.
Quite a battery.
Yeah. See, in Gardella, that was in 46, but he didn't stay with us.
Maybe in Mexico.
Some of these guys, like Ace Adams, the first one in the book went, he jumped.
Yeah.
He never did come back either.
Gardella came back for just a few games in 1950, I believe.
Did he go to
Mexico? Yeah. Another part of my hobby, you know, tied into this interviewing, is I collect baseball autographs. And I wrote to Mr. Gardella for his autograph. Uh-huh. And when it came back, that caused me to do some searching for him. Yeah. It was sort of interesting. He wrote his name, and he wrote the years he was with the Giants, and he put underneath Mel Ott, manager. He's obviously very, very proud of that.
Uh-huh.
And he sent a photograph of him having hit a home run, crossing the plate, and Mel Ott congratulating him.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was sort of interesting, so I checked him out a little bit. Here's a name I know, Charlie Fox, who later managed.
Sure, he managed the Giants.
Right.
I can remember him coming up as a kid trying to get a job, you know what
uh-huh.
I mean? He was just catching bat practice, and here after all of that, he went on and he had a pretty good career and his manager and everything, so you never know what that was going to happen. I can remember Charlie, little young whippersnap kid.
Yeah, there's Gardell, he's back in New York now.
Bill Rigney, he played shortstop for us too.
Right.
And he went on to, manager for a long time. But when you're talking about New York and you're talking about San Francisco, it's just night and day, know what I mean? You don't even associate yourself with San Francisco.
Right, it's a different world entirely. It's a different
ballpark. San Francisco just recently they started up a former baseball club where they're trying to get in touch with everybody that played with the Giants in New York and trying to get a brochure on everybody. They wrote me here 5-6 months ago. They're putting out a paper every few months, 5-6 months they put out and they go through what's happening in the organization.
Uh-huh.
And they always tie in some former player and so forth.
Not a bad idea.
And they keep up with the memorial to all the players that died. At least you know what the hell is going on. Some of the players that you play with, you find out they passed on, you know.
I forgot Dan Lingle Mungo was on Giants that year.
Oh, Mungo, he was a card. He was a card. Anything would happen to him. Anything that could happen would happen to him. He was just somebody never knew what was going on.
Now, is Bill Voisel one of those players that you're talking about who really didn't do much after the war?
Bill was, he was totally deaf. Couldn't hear a thing.
Really?
Couldn't hear a thing. So how he did as well as he did, you know, it's amazing. Couldn't hardly talk to him, you know, unless he must have been able to read lips.
Yeah.
So he wasn't very easy to get along with.
I hadn't heard that at all.
Not that you couldn't converse
with
him.
Yeah, I understood what you meant.
Sure.
I didn't think that you meant he was a hard person to deal with.
No, he was a mountain type guy too. He came up and he was with the Giants in 43, and he was with them in 44,
good season,
45.
44.
Yeah. But you see, you had, when you're talking years like that, you didn't, the type of players you had, you know, I mean, the type of players are altogether different than what you have in, you know, baseball.
Tommy Gorman, is that the...
Tommy Gorman is the guy that was an umpire.
That's what I was going to ask. He became an umpire.
Yeah, Tommy, I played with Tommy in the minors. Then he went into umpiring.
You're right, I've never seen anything like this. Play ball. Brochure of his signatures. Pirates here, and there's one, I don't see a signature I expected to see, Honus Wagner, wasn't he a coach? There he is, yeah, he's a coach at
yeah,
that time.
Yeah, Honus was, he was still there when I was pitching. It was strange to see a guy as old as he was, older than he was, it's strange to try and project him back into a being the greatest, one of the greatest players, you know, but that shows you what age, age does you have.
Well, he's one of the persons I think I would have most liked to have met. And what little I know about him, he must have been an interesting person to know.
Yeah. Well, you see, he had he's cut along the same lines as the Mets manager and the Yankees manager,
Stengel,
Casey, you know, those old guys, they live baseball, they talk baseball, they slept baseball, and that's the kind of ball guys they were. They've been in it for 50 years, and what else do they know about baseball?
It was when I was reading a biography of Casey Stengel, I first realized something I should have known. Of course, they had minor league ball team in Joliet. He played in, Casey Stengel played in Joliet in 1910.
Yeah, there.
That's something else I think would be interesting to look into.
Well, they used to, you know, they used to have a lot of all these talented baseball teams.
Sure,
I'd say back in the 20s and 30s. I mean, even in the farm areas. I know I used to go out and visit my cousin. He lived in Gardner, Illinois, but the farms were 10 miles apart, but they always Sunday they throw their glove and their spikes into the back of a truck, and they'd head for some field out in the middle of nowhere, you know what I mean? And they'd have their ball game, and then after it was over, that was it.
I grew up going to minor league games in Topeka, Kansas.
Oh, yeah?
And, well, I'm sure you knew Johnny Vandermeer. He was the manager then, for the team then. They haven't had a team there in at least 40 years.
was there, Harry Denning. I didn't realize that 40 was his last year with the. Well, 40, or maybe it was, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I think he was there more than that.
I would have thought so. The interesting thing about those, and it's hard to come by, is give minor league records too. Sometimes that's hard to find.
Yeah.
42 was his last year.
40, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Because I knew he was there a lot.
119 games that year. That's
yeah.
A pretty cool year.
Yeah. Well, he was a big pitcher. But he was, you know, he was altogether different. Type of a catcher that I would say Gabby was, he was a real good catcher for him.
Well, what do you mean they were different? You mean the way in which they handled the pitchers?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you have some catchers that, well, you could, if you ever watch the Cubs, I watch them and it just makes me sick to see a catcher go back there and all he's doing is sticking that fastball, and they're knocking the pitcher's jack off, you know what I mean? And he keeps coming back with a fastball. If a guy's got any kind of a curveball, you mix things up. You don't keep coming in there. And I can't understand how a manager can sit there and let a catcher do that to him.
And if the pitcher hasn't got some kind of a curveball, what's he doing in the majors?
Well, that nowadays pitchers are different than what when they were in my time. If you didn't have a curveball, you Katie barred the door. You couldn't stay up there. But now they got a what they call a split finger. We never had anything like that, and they don't have a curveball. And they throw a slider. Slider breaks this far, you know what I mean? All it does is it slides. When you're talking a curveball...
It breaks.
It breaks a foot, and if you miss it, you're not gonna hit it. It's gonna be clear away from the bat. But when you're throwing a slider and it breaks this far, you still can adjust enough to whack it. The curveball, if you're guessing fastball and somebody throws you a curve, there's no way in the world you're going to catch up with a curveball if you're swinging for a fastball.
Well, slider was just coming into the majors, wasn't it,
right?
About the time that
yeah.
you were pitching?
We
did you fool around
no.
with it? Or?
No. Curve, your basic pitches in those days are the curveball, fastball, and something that they call a change of pace. Mm-hmm. And it just was slower than your fastball and in between your curveball. Naturally, when you throw a curveball, it's going to be slower than your fastball. Wind resistance and everything else is going to slow it down.
Who had the best fastball in the National League those years?
You had Derringer over Cincinnati. He was pretty fast, and his sidekick,
Bucky Walters.
He was a great pitcher. I thought he was a great pitcher. Yeah, he was a great pitcher. Claude Pazeau with the Cubs. He was another good pitcher. But I've seen pitchers that could go out there and they could throw a ball through a brick wall. I mean, they can knock the ball down. But I don't give a damn what batter stands up there. You just keep throwing that thing that he's gonna time it.
Uh-huh.
He's gonna time it. It may take him a time at bat to do it, but you're not gonna throw a fastball by him. But if you've got a guy that throws a fastball and he's got a decent curve, they're not gonna be setting on his fastball all the time. And that's what makes pitchers nowadays have trouble, because a lot of them do not have curveballs. You cannot go out there. You can do it if you're a relief pitcher like Smith with the
Cardinals.
You can get by for one inning. You can get by throwing that thing. But the second time around, they're going to whack you. They're going to get you. They're going to get you.
Well, I asked you who had the best fastball. Who had the best curveball?
Best curveball I saw was, not in our league, was Bob Feller. And he had the best fastball, too.
Well, that's why I was asking you about National League. You know, Bob Feller kind of dominated things.
Well, he had a wicked fastball. But his curveball fell right off the table, too, so he had two things going for him. He had two things going for him. He had Higby with Brooklyn. He had a pretty, and Woodrow Wyatt, he was pretty fast, too, which you would say you interviewed. Higby, well, when you talk, there are very few pitchers that have fastballs that are really outstanding. You've got the guy with Boston now,
Clemens.
He's a good fastball pitcher. But he's also has a fastball that tends to rise.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's coming in here. And by the time they're swinging at it, it's out of the strike zone up here. And that's how he strikes out a lot of them, because his fastball isn't down in the strike zone all the time. It's coming into a batter, and he thinks, oh, I'm going to time this. And by the time it's rising on him. And maybe it only rises as much, but it's enough to make him. So he's a different type fastball pitcher. He's not a low fastball pitcher. You can really time it. If you stay with him, you're going to time it fast enough, but his ball rises. So he's what you call a live fastball pitcher. He's pitching and his ball is moving all the time. Some of them got a fastball and it's just like
it's
an arrow. Don't move, don't sink, it don't do anything, it don't rise. It just comes straight in there. Well, those kind of guys are much easier to hit than somebody that's sinking or doing this. Makes it tougher to hit.
Was anybody throwing a screwball other than Hubble?
I tried. But it's hard on your arm. Yeah. Boy, it's tough on your arm. Well, Hubble got sick.
Yeah.
His arm was,
he had a permanent twist to his arm, didn't he?
Because when you throw it, when he throws it, this is the way your arm has got to work. Mm-hmm. It's got to go against, your arm twists this way. Your curveball, you twist this way. Screwball, you're just twisting your arm and your shoulder.
You do that enough thousand times.
Oh, God. But he was fortunate enough he could do it, but of course it deformed his arm, but he didn't give a damn about that. He was a good pitcher.
Now you said you threw three quarters. What about sidearms or any submarine hurlers that you remember?
Oh yeah, there was some. But There again, a side armor.
An unnatural.
Side armor nowadays it don't work because they got two different lineups.
Mm-hmm.
Side arm, a left hander can see a side armor coming the minute he starts his arm moving because it's running right into him. A right-hander, he's backing away, you know what I mean? He thinks he's going to get hit by the ball. But the left-hander just rides in, so if side armor pitches the game, everybody's going to be left-handed against him. That's why a lot of times you see him bring a side armor in for relief. And right away, if you got any right-handed batters coming up, they're gonna pinch hit with all left-handers. They can read them. So the side armor is why you would even want to. If I was going to be a sidearm pitcher, I'd rather pitch to try to go underhand. More underhand, yeah. Because then your ball is sinking.
Who was doing that in the early 40s?
Now you didn't have many of those guys around.
I don't guess you ever have a lot of them. It's still a real specialty sort of pitcher.
Well, a lot of times you talk to pitchers that are pitching that way in the big leagues, they hurt their arm. They've hurt their shoulder where they can't.
They're pitching that way to compensate.
They're doing it. They had to go that way to even stay in pitching because they can't raise their shoulder.
Any knuckleball pitchers?
Yeah, quite a few
knuckleballers. Any spitballers still around? I know they were all supposed to be gone.
I think there was, when I first started in, there was one. Now, who the hell was it?
Well, Burley Grimes was.
I think that was the one, Burley Grimes. And of course, that had to be in, like in spring training when I was there with Reeler, a young 18 years old. He used to play all these other clubs, and I think that he was the only one left. He stole through.
There were a couple people who were accused, I guess.
Kirby
Higbee was accused.
A lot of them. I mean, a lot of them. Whether they do it or not, you got to catch them at it. Now you can't put your hand to your mouth or to your lips or anything when you're on the mound without backing off the mound and getting off of the circle and rubbing the ball up and so forth. They're trying to get away from all of that, but nevertheless, they can go back here. When you're pitching a ball game, the wettest part of you is your hair back here, and you go back here and you get a handful of wet. So what's the difference, you know?
From the ball pool.
Or even the side of
your
face, full of sweat. So you can, if you want to wet the ball, you can do it, but it's hard when it comes into the catcher. Some of it could still be on there, so they'll nail you at it, you know.
Yeah, I couldn't believe what I've read, that even a spitball, when it's hit, an infielder could still be catching a ball that's wet. How wet must a spitball be in order for that to happen?
It is the whole ball. It's
just
part
a part
of it that is going to affect the turning of the ball as it's coming up to the plate. It's going to change. Instead of it being a smooth ball, it's got like something stuck to it, and it's changing the motion of the ball. Same way with a knuckleball. I mean, a knuckleball is a ball that's thrown without any rotation. They try to push it at you, and it just, instead of turning, it's just coming at you with the seams like it's held there, you know what I mean? So the wind current is catching it, and the guy that throws it don't even know where the hell it's going to go. It's just the way the wind catches it. That's what they call it. It's surprising. A lot of my guys don't use it. I would think that it would be a hell of a pitch. And it's not banned.
No, it isn't.
It isn't banned. But there again, you gotta have, I didn't have what you call real strong nails. You know, some of these guys, their nails are so tough where they could just dig into the ball. You know, now that's a good knuckleball pitcher. It's gotta have big, strong fingernails because it all comes off of your nails.
You mentioned Clemens and Smith. What other pitchers do you think are particularly good? Which other pitchers of today do you like?
Well, Sutcliffe, before he had a mix-up of pitches.
Yeah.
You go to the Mets. Of course, you got the nigger, the
Gooden. You think he's blown his arm out? You think he
could be? Could be. It's in anytime you get shoulder problems. Those are the bad ones, because when I was playing, guys coming up with shoulders, bad shoulders. They didn't know what was wrong. You didn't have any good doctors. The minute you had a shoulder problem, nobody would touch it. Nobody would go in with a knife. C- because they go in with a knife and you'd be worse off. Now they call it rotator cuff and all of that, and they're still willing to open you up and go in there and perform surgery on you. Now, my day, I was lucky to get my elbow fixed up. I had to go to Johns Hopkins, a specialist, that's all he did was work on that kind of an injury, you know?
Wyatt said that he had an elbow injury one time, and he was given a heat treatment that was so severe it burned his arm almost to the point where it almost ruined his arm completely.
Right?
So, you know, it was obvious.
When I hurt my shoulder, when I first hurt my shoulder when I was, what, 20 years old? I came home that year, and I still got the heat lamp upstairs, believe it or not. I bought a infrared heat lamp. And I baked my arm every night the whole winter. And by the time the spring came along, it was like a baked ham, you know what I mean? But nobody else could help me. Nobody, doctors. They didn't have any doctors then. I mean, maybe your team doctor was a baby doctor, you know what I mean? You go in there and if you hurt your knee or something, no x-rays, no nothing. Oh, you'll be all right in a couple of days. Maybe that was all there was to it. Our trainer was Willie Schaefer. He was an ex-boxer. Now, what did he know about training? The guy did the best he could, but all he did was pour alcohol on you and rub the hell out of you, you know what I mean? Or give you a diathermy treatment. If you had a sore arm, he'd put the diathermy on you and cook you a little bit. And stretch, boy, he used to believe in stretching your arm until you thought he was pulling it out of the socket. Whether he was doing it any good or not, I don't have the slightest idea, but he damn near killed you, you know what I mean? But that's all you had in those days.
Well, that's something that's changed then, obviously,
oh,
in the last
man,
50
now,
years.
Now they've got these... equipment places right in their dressing area. And I think one thing I think these guys are doing, I think they're over they're building up their muscles to such an extent that they're hurting themselves.
Losing flexibility.
Right. I mean, they come out with big thighs like this, and they run to first base, and then they got a pull muscle and they're out for a month. Type of ball players that I always liked, that I always admired, were guys like the long, slender type guys, you know what I mean? That didn't have the big, like Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio. The long, slender type guys rather than the big guys, the muscle guys. Because they seemed to have more resiliency in their muscles were like rubber bands, you know what I mean? They just had and they weren't muscular at all.
Maybe Cal Ripken is that way.
To a degree. The big ones that have the big bulging muscles and cut their shirts off there, they run the first base and they pull a muscle and they're out for 2 months with a pulled muscle in their thigh. Why? When I played ball, I remember, I wouldn't even want to go in swimming because you use your muscles differently. You use your muscles. I wouldn't think of bowling. Throwing a ball down there with your arm not even stretched or anything else and you're going to tear something. I wouldn't do that. There were a lot of things that I wouldn't do. I wouldn't play this or I wouldn't play that because I was scared of hurting my arm. But now they go in there and they lift 400 pounds, and their muscles are so damn bulging. I don't think it helps them a damn bit. I think it hinders them.
You talked about base running. We haven't touched on that subject at all. Base running has changed some in the past 50 years. A lot more stolen bases, but I think that probably 50 years ago there were smarter base runners, and you know, like going first to third.
We didn't concentrate on that type of baseball. Nobody seemed to concentrate on stealing bases. He had no, I don't recall of any teams having special coaches to get you to lead off first base in a certain way. I don't think they even dwelled on that too. I don't recall any team ever dwelling on that or how to slide. I mean, I played 12 years in baseball, and I've yet to have anybody tell me how to slide into second base. The speed concept, that wasn't a part of baseball back in those days.
Well, what about advancing on, say, a fly ball?
The fundamentals, everybody worked on.
Well, what were the fundamentals?
What were the
fundamentals? Yeah, when you say everybody worked on the fundamentals, can you be more specific?
Well, I mean, when you're on first base, you've got to know who's playing your outfield, what kind of arms they have. They got strong arms, they got weak arms, where the ball is hit, if you're on first base and it's hit into an area where it's going to be more difficult for him to throw, you've got to have it in your mind that if it goes there, I'm going to do this. You know what I mean? It's something that's drilled into you. It becomes a second nature to you. You know what I mean?
Is it learned more in the minors then?
It had to be.
Was something that you were.
You don't have minors anymore. You don't have minors anymore. Right. Well, what minors in the minor leagues do you have? They come out of college and they go into double A or what they call triple A. The basics of baseball were taught these guys down in the D leagues and C leagues, where they played every damn day for 150 games, just like they do in the big leagues, or close to it. And they were taught that, and it was just became a part of your baseball knowledge. Now they come out of college. What can they teach them in college? Can they teach them how to run bases, how to get leadoffs, how to do this and do that? They don't have enough time. They play 40 games a year if they're lucky. In the northern part of the state, they don't play 40 games.
No.
You don't have time to you don't have time to school. And I can see what is. If they can pay somebody in the big leagues $29 million, why in the hell can't they have some lower classifications where you have more kids that are interested in baseball, that want to play baseball, and put more money into raising more players instead of going down into Venezuela or all these southern countries and getting your ball players there? We got guys here that should be able to play ball. We always had them. Why shouldn't it be now?
There are more teams, but there are more people in the country too.
Now you got a kid. He's a halfway decent player in high school. He's happy to go over to Jewel's and put cans on the shelf on a Saturday and Sunday and make $4 an hour rather than go out and play baseball. And they can go out and they can make millions of dollars. It don't make sense.
Right.
Don't add up. And these ball clubs can go and pay a guy $29 million, and they won't spend $1 million a year on having a few teams trying to and paying them a living wage that they, you know what I mean, not. Go down there and pay him $200 a month. Who the hell is going to go down there and play anything for $200? Give him a halfway decent salary. Sure, a lot of them aren't going to make it, but a lot of them aren't going to make it.
Well, with the television contracts running out, a lot of the economic makeup of the game is going to change pretty quickly.
But on the other hand, you can see what's coming up. Free baseball on television isn't going to be in 5-10 years. A lot of it's going to be you call up and they'll put $5 on your cable bill, or you want to watch this team or that team. So the money is still going to be there.
From a different
way. From a different way. What the hell?
Cubs Park can hold, hold 35 million people, or 35,000 people, and they got a an airway. If they even if they charge a dollar a head for on cable, and they can show it to a million people, that's $1 million a day. You're trying to Notre Dame the other Saturday and playing football. There's a perfect example. Shut you out unless you pay the money. A lot of people say the hell with you. I won't pay it. Maybe it'll hurt the game in the long run. Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. But, I mean, you go to a ball game now. You bring a family, it costs you what, $100 $100 a ball game? By the time you eat a $2.50 hot dog and a $1.25 Coke, and and by the time you get out, you got to spend another hour and a half getting home. You know, I see a couple of games a year, maybe go down there, but I'd sit here in front of this bag, in front of this thing. If the game gets out of hand, the hell with it.
Or if it rains, or whatever else.
Turn it off and go on to something.